Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Notable.
Here we go then. Should I just pick up? Should I start? Do you want to start, Elizabeth?
Yeah, go on. You start.
Only because I've got to go and get me chips in a bit. Is that fine? Huh? Great.
Welcome again to Notable Show 4, Series 2.
Hello. Yes, Series 2. Lots of debate. Still raging.
Raging.
Over that on Twitter.
Season.
Series or season. At Notable Pod, just to give our social media a little bit of a plug.
Absolutely. Plug it away. We need to We need to do that. And we need to say thank you.
If we don't plug it, then who will, frankly?
Well, there is that. And also, we should thank the people who are getting in touch with us on social media. We're at Notable Pod and we're on Instagram. And obviously, it goes without saying, like us, subscribe us.
Retweet.
Tell your friends that this is the podcast for anybody who's interested in fascinating stories and great music.
Absolutely. Music from all eras and all genres. That's what we do. As today's episode is proof, Stuart.
It is indeed. We've got some trad jazz from Elizabeth in a moment. Well, trad jazz is not really fair, is it? It's the godfather in many ways of a whole generation of British music.
Yeah. Ken Collier.
Ken Collier.
We'll learn that in a moment.
And I'm going to kick off by telling you about the strangest hit single ever, which many of you will know, many of you will love, some of you might hate, actually. It polarises people and has been polarising people for 40 years because it's just celebrated its 40th birthday and been reissued on vinyl and stuff. The Parent album has, anyway. And, of course, I'm talking about Oh Superman by Laurie Anderson. Are you a fan, Elizabeth?
I am a huge fan. I love her. And she's such a gentle soul, isn't she?
Yeah.
She's beautiful. I've interviewed her a couple of times. She's a big dog lover, so instantly we got on. She's done a concert for dogs.
She has.
And she was married to Lou Reed.
I know.
Imagine that.
I know.
So all respect to the woman, frankly.
Who put the bins out, do you think?
In the
Anderson.
Did they live in the same house?
I'm not sure they did.
Let's not speculate too wildly over that, but she's gorgeous, isn't she?
She is, and
wonderful.
And she starts off life as a performance artist in that very fertile sort of New York downtown loft art scene, from which came Philip Glass and Steve Reich and people like that. Lots of dancers, lots of theatre people.
One of my favourite things that she did: she used to fall asleep in public places.
Yes,
and then record her dreams. And there's photographs of her asleep in these, in the Colin Hardy civic buildings or whatever it is. So, I love that idea.
Well, the big piece that made her name in the early 1980s is this 7-hour multimedia project called United States 1-5. It was the hot ticket on that scene. And in this, she would stand on blocks of ice and she would play the violin made of tape, audio tape, and all these kinds of things. Lots of visuals, very much of its time, performance art. Brilliant, brilliantly received, a hot ticket. One segment was a piece called Oh Superman, inspired by events in 1979, the abortive mission. Well, it was actually the Iranian students stormed the US embassy in Tehran and there was an abortive attempt to get people out of there. And a helicopter and a plane crashed in the desert. And she wanted to write about this, about technology and warfare and how it resonated and coincided then. And a couple of weeks...
Unlikely subject matter for a pop hit.
absolutely. Everything about this is unlikely, including its source material, because she said that she'd heard just a little before an aria called El Cid by Massenet, the French composer. Yeah. Massenet, which is why, if you look, the full title of O Superman is O Superman, brackets, for Massenet. And there's a song in there that she'd heard sung by an African-American tenor called O Sovereign.
It's a prayer, isn't it?
It's a prayer, yeah. It's a prayer to authority, which is a really sinister idea, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess like a one-sided conversation or a rant at God or whatever.
Yeah, but it, O Sovereign, you know, O Master, all this. This is the idea of the song, that it's a sort of song of supplication to authority. And it felt sinister. So she did the same thing and updated it. So you get, oh, Superman, oh, Judge, oh, Mom and Dad. She's conflating power, authority, the family. Hold me in your long arms, your petrochemical arms, your military arms. And she throws in even a bit of the rather lovely, I always think, sort of supposed slogan of the United States Post Office. You know that bit? Neither snow nor rain nor gloom of night shall stay these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds.
Yeah, which is originally a description of the horseback couriers of Imperial Persia.
Wow.
Which is the Iranian connection.
Wow. So this is, if you like, a banger from this seven-hour thing. This is one of the ones that get people excited, you know, and it's got this looped ha-ha-ha-ha-ha on a vocoder.
Is it spoken word? People debate this, don't they? I was reading in the Financial Times before, they were, you know, they were talking about Sprechgesang. I just casually stumbled across this piece about O Superman in the Financial Times. But they were talking about Sprechgesang, which is, you know, that kind of German style of singing that's spoken. It means spoken and
making
sung.
It's making a big comeback with a lot of terrible indie bands who sound like third-rate versions of The Fall trying to do it. Yeah, it's making a comeback.
Yeah, Marquis Smith was very Sprechgesang, wasn't he?
Very.
But they were saying it was more Sprech than Gesang.
I don't think it is. I think there's a good bit of Gesang in there. The O Superman is definitely sung, isn't it?
It's lyrical. It's lyrical.
I mean, there is some Sprecht in there, but there's a lot of Gesang.
Yeah, I've seen it listed as one of the, you know, in the sort of top 10 or top 100 spoken word tracks as well.
Well, this...
But there's another debate to rage on our social media.
Well, you absolutely rage away. Is it Sprecht or Gesang? So this dude called Bob George has got involved with the project. He's put out some of Laurie Anderson's work on compilations before, and he's the co-director of United States. And he says, that's a single, which is crazy. He says, that's a single, I think. And he urges her to put it out as a single. Gets a grant for $500 from the National Endowment, which is kind of arts thing in the States. They record it in her hallway because it's the quietest place they can find. And he said, I suggested she slow it down so that if it gets played on the radio, it got more in royalties. Now, I think that might be a bit of a fib. But anyway, Laurie...
So he asked us to slow it down?
Yes.
What, it was too quick? It was too quick? Because it's really long, isn't it?
It is.
Is it 8 minutes long or something like that?
I'm not entirely sure of how much of Bob's testimony is on the money. So, but I know what
You don't want him as you are your A&R man,
no,
do you?
No, no. Laurie...
Slow down this 8-minute record.
It's not long enough, yeah. So Laurie says, like, you know, she's from this performance art world. She says, I've no interest in pop, but I got convinced to put it out as a single. Mail order. They press up 1,000 copies and they individually wrap and post each one. And one of them finds its way to John Peel in London, who loves it and starts to play it. And it takes off here.
He pays it backwards or at the wrong speed as well.
Well, probably. No, I think he actually managed to get this one right. Yeah. Suddenly there's a furore about this amazing track on Peel. The British distribution company said, can you get us 80,000 copies of this? Such is the demand. So they have to go in for professional distribution. Warner Brothers, who had already been interested in her, they say...
They've been going to her shows, haven't they?
Yeah, and they said, because they know she can't do this at home now, 80,000 copies. They say, we will do you the 80,000 copies, and in return, we'll give you an 8-album deal. Like, for a performance artist, this is extraordinary.
It is, yeah.
Peel plays it, it takes off, it starts to climb the charts. And she says, it was absurd, it was unreal, I was kind of in the art world, but I realised that because... She says, I'd always had money as a kid. I grew up in a family with money and I knew it didn't make you happier, it didn't make you smarter, and it didn't make you freer. In fact, it often did the opposite of these things. But no one, I don't think she would deny that she is now an established world artist with her foot in several camps because of O Superman and the brilliant Parents album, Big Science, we should say, which is fabulous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And people found her other more obscure work, didn't they?
Exactly. And it didn't get to number one.
It got to number two, didn't it?
I remember at the time, because I loved it, thinking, has the man stopped it from getting to number one like he did with the Sex Pistols because it's too weird? And I don't think that's the case. I think records sold a lot then. And the one that this is strange as well, though. The thing that stopped it getting to number one is also one of the weirdest hit singles ever. It's My Party, the cover of It's My Party, yeah, by Dave Stewart and Barbara Gaskin, who themselves weren't pop people at all. They come from the very niche bit of English progressive rock, the Canterbury scene. I don't know if you're familiar with bands like Hatfield and the North and Soft National Machine. Health and Soft Machine and Henry Cow and those people.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're from that world. They're absolutely from that world of mildly political, definitely strange English, very English progressive rock. They did a pop cover of Leslie Gore's It's My Party, and that got to number one, and that kept Oh Superman off, which is really strange. And she said, my friends in the art world said to me, you're selling out, you're selling out. But later, she said, people started to use the term crossing over. And she didn't perform the song live for a long time until 9/11. And suddenly, she said, it got a whole new resonance again. The planes, here come the planes. They're American planes, not American. Well, they are American planes, but not piloted by Americans.
Which, strangely, is when it was 20 years old, isn't it?
That's right. That is very true. Yeah,
2001.
And people said it.
Because it's a year older than I am.
Right, okay. But yes, and it suddenly got a whole new... She began to perform it again live because it had this new resonance. And she said, we're in the same war... And our planes are still crashing, which essentially it was. It's still about the US involvement in the Middle East and oil and things like that, yeah. So, yeah, happy birthday to the strangest hit single ever, Oh Superman by Laurie Anderson. But...
Why do you think it was so popular?
I think it's just...
Because it is so unlikely. And like you say, you know, even for it to be kept off number one by... It's what was happening at the time, you know, that those two songs were number one and number two. And
I don't know if there's anything particularly to do with the time. I just think Oh Superman is one of those
81.
Records. I'm sure some of the people who bought it almost bought it as like they buy a novelty record. I think there was sheer novelty involved. But, you know, it's so long, it's so weird, you know. But
like Tubular Bells, it's a little bit like that, isn't it, I suppose?
It's a more challenging listen than Tubular Bells, I suppose, in some ways, isn't it? But it is just one of those records that gets under your skin. I remember at the time it coming out and me thinking, this is just brilliant. And I know, although people would kind of make fun of it in some ways, a lot of people hate it, a lot of people who wouldn't normally like avant-garde music were just sucked in by it. It is the repetitive nature of it, the lyrical nature of it, and it's got such a brilliant vibe, hasn't it? That the melancholy and eeriness of it.
Yeah. Hypnotic.
Hypnotic is absolutely right. We can't play Oh Superman for copyright reasons, but we're now, Elizabeth and I, are going to do vocally all 8 minutes and 21 seconds of it. You ready, Elizabeth? Should we stop?
Yeah, okay. I was getting into it, though.
I know, I could tell.
It's trance-like. Actually, the opening of the Matinee is very similar in mood and tone, possibly even key signature, I was thinking, when I was listening to it before.
Right.
And I was thinking, I can hear that.
Great.
They'd sound nice together on the radio,
great,
I think. I don't know what station will play that.
It leads us to a notable exception. Every week on the show, we have a notable exception.
Which is always music to our ears, isn't it?
Because we always forget.
We always forget to do
this. We always forget, and then after...
And then Jeff gets very annoyed with us.
That's right. And before you get to hear this, dear listener, we've had to think of a notable exception. But I thought of one in advance today.
Usually just before we record. So it's scrabbling around.
By our standards, this is absolute preparation because notable exception...
Although I don't even know what it is yet, to be fair. Go on, Stuart.
Okay. Well, the pop documentaries on BBC Four on a Friday night and all those shows always will say, Oh Superman by Laurie Anderson got to number one, or got to number two, I beg your pardon, because of John Peel and his championing, and it was only played on late night radio. It's the only single ever to be a hit with never getting played on daytime radio. And apparently that's not true. A guy called John Kuttner, when I was researching this, says in the summer of 81, he was working on the Radio 1 roadshow in Cornwall with Tony Blackburn. They've been in St Austell. They have a few drinks in the bar. I've been on Radio 1 roadshows. I know what goes on. But he goes to bed for a Radio 1 roadshow, I think, quite early, about 11 o'clock, puts the radio on in his bedroom, hears John Peel playing Oh Superman. Loves it. Gets back to London, goes to Peel's office and says, I heard that track you played. It was amazing. And he says, it's come from this independent PR guy called Scott Peering, who also did The Smiths at the time. And he gets hold of a copy of it, John Kuttner, takes it to Simon Bates, who he produces. and says to Bates, look, it's a long record, but what do you think of it? And he says, he remembers, Simon Bates played it once, maybe in the maybe just after the golden hour or just after our tune. And Bates himself said, it seems to go on forever, mate, but I like it. And so it did get played one, at least once.
Wow,
for the purposes of our notable exception, we're saying once. And John Kuttner also says, did you know that that, ha, 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 there are 1,246 ha, ha, ha's on the song? He knows because he had to count them for a Radio 1 competition.
Really?
So there you go. It's the strangest hit single ever, but it did get played on daytime radio.
Cracking notable exception, that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So, I'm going to tell you about Ken Collier Stewart. Are you into historic moments?
Totally.
Who isn't?
I live for them.
So, October 1949, a corrugated iron hut round the side of the White Hart pub in Bath Road, Cranford. Kind of ramshackle jazz band led by a man called Ken Collier. Introduced a handful of curious fans. There's always only a few people in the room at these occasions, isn't there?
Yeah.
Curious fans, handful of them, and they're hearing this new kind of music. It's primitive, it's raw. The band had devised it themselves. It was called Skiffle.
Right.
And it was going to change the whole course of popular music forever.
Okay.
So the story of Ken Collier's life and career is kind of completely woven together with the story of this musical form, Skiffle, and how it began, how it developed. He was born in Great Yarmouth in 1928, raised in London, by all accounts, pretty poverty-stricken, mm-hmm. Dismal upbringing. He called the flat where he was raised, it was on Fitzroy Square, so it certainly wouldn't be called this now. He called it bug-ridden flats.
Right.
A lot of sadness as well. His sister Daphne died quite young. She fell down some stairs and had diphtheria and this sort of thing. So very sort of rundown part of London, a lot of poverty in his childhood. He had an older brother called Bill, who went off to fight in the Second World War. Ken was left at home with Bill's collection of jazz records. I'm, as an oldest child, and maybe you feel like this as an only child, I'm always so jealous of people who had older siblings that introduced them to music, because I just never had that. So I always felt a little bit behind.
Did you?
As a teenager, for sure, yeah. All my friends who had older siblings would always get things first.
I would always inherit it
through them and be on a bit of a back foot.
Okay.
Anyway, so Ken Collier had an older brother, Bill. Just as an aside, jazz was pretty popular in the UK after the First World War. American soldiers had brought it over to Europe during the First World War, early forms of jazz. Interestingly, elsewhere in Europe, places like France, there was quite a lot of snobbery towards American art forms, and it didn't quite take off like it did here in the UK.
Right.
So jazz was big in London in the 30s. Melody Maker were big enthusiasts.
It was a jazz paper.
It was, yeah. Which I love to think that, you know, that they were like trying to get hold of like the first jazz records, you know, considering what they became. Jazz bands on the BBC at that time. Louis Armstrong played residencies in London and Glasgow actually in the 30s. Duke Ellington also came here between the wars. So jazz was like very much, you know, the thing that everybody, that the kids were listening to. So Ken Collier is at home, teenage Ken, his brother's away fighting in the Second World War. He really gets into this music. He starts to learn the cornets, first of all.
Okay.
Dreams of one day going to New Orleans, which is very much the home of Dixieland jazz, which is the style of jazz that was popular
at the time. Yeah, and the cornet was Big Spiderbeck's instrument, wasn't it?
Yeah. So Dixieland, it's kind of a mix of blues, ragtime, also funeral marching bands or funeral processions. Ken not only dreams of going to New Orleans, he actually goes there. So as soon as he's old enough, he joins the Merchant Navy and he gets himself to America. Apparently, he drove everybody crazy practicing, by this point, the trumpet. He moved on from the cornet to the trumpet on board ship. I think, like, he didn't have any friends in the Merchant Navy because I suppose it takes weeks to sail to America, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Everyone gets scurvy and seasickness.
It's a couple of weeks, isn't it?
Is it 2 weeks? There's like icebergs and monsters everywhere, and then
there's no monsters. Can we just go back a little there? When Elizabeth says there's monsters there, there aren't. So don't let that put you off traveling. When lockdown eases, don't let that put you off traveling to America.
Maybe on board ship. I don't know if I fancy getting a boat to America.
Right, I'd love it, but I don't think I'd want someone playing the trumpet 24/7
the whole time. No, I wouldn't exactly. Just like no. Blah, blah, blah.
So
he doesn't get to New Orleans the first time. He spends some time in New York instead. He goes to all the jazz clubs there. Hears music by the big players at the time. Wild Bill Davidson was a particular favorite. Pee Wee Russell, Oscar Peterson.
Yeah.
So Ken Collier has a crazy time in New York. He realizes he doesn't want to be in the Merchant Navy and just visit these places and kind of, you know, be into jazz as a hobby. He actually wants it to become his life. So he comes back to the UK. He forms a jazz band. They were actually quite successful. They were called the Crane River Jazz Band.
Yeah.
They performed at the Royal Festival Hall in 1951 for the Queen. They supported Big Bill Brunsey.
Yeah, brilliant guitarist.
In London as well.
Yeah.
But all this wasn't, you know, wasn't enough to satisfy his ambition. He was, I don't know, he just takes kind of authenticity to a whole new level. He didn't just want the success, even though this band were doing really well. He kind of leaves the band, decides he still needs to go to the source of this music that he loves, this Dixieland jazz, mm-hmm. and he wants to go back to New Orleans. I, last year, went to Tennessee, mm-hmm. and it's actually really hard, even now, getting to those southern states. I mean, I went with Sinead Garver, mm-hmm. and we didn't really check our flight times very well.
Yeah.
It took us 24 hours.
So what are you saying? It's literally difficult to get to them in planes?
Well, it's still difficult, even now. Yeah, 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 yeah. It's quite hard. Well, yeah, we flew from London, and you've got to change, and, you know, the flights are really long and really expensive. There's not that, you know, it's actually still quite hard.
Okay.
It's just a mission.
Okay.
So then it must have been even harder. Anyway, he rejoins the Merchant Navy and he wants to get back to America. He jumps ship, probably to the relief of his shipmates.
Yes.
His trumpet skeptic shipmates. Yeah. He jumps ship at Alabama and he gets a one-way ticket to New Orleans and he goes there. And he does meet all the greats at this time. People like George Lewis and Percy Humphrey, they were sort of the big players in New Orleans at this time. He spends time with them playing. He gets some big tours with these big names, really hones his craft. His visa expires on Christmas Day, unfortunately,
right.
So he can't go and get it renewed because obviously everything's closed. Mm. And then by the time he's able to get to the office to renew his visa, he's already outstayed his welcome. He ends up in prison and he's deported.
Right.
He always maintained that he was deported because he'd been performing alongside black musicians, which at the time was still frowned upon, really sadly, even though, you know, we're in the early 50s now in the States. Mm. But he thinks that's why they, you know, they made the kind of harsh decision to send him back. So he's back on ship. He comes back to London. During this whole time, his brother had been sending letters to Melody Maker, kind of updating the Melody Maker on his progress in New Orleans.
Right.
So he arrives back a bit of a hero of the jazz scene. He's met in London by his brother, Bill, and Chris Barber.
Who's another big name here, yeah.
He is. And, you know, I didn't realise he passed away in March this year.
He did.
He was 90 years old. Oh. I interviewed him once, and he was lovely. In fact, I made a programme about this with Billy Bragg mm-hmm. about 13 years ago. And we met Chris Barber in the 100 Club in the West End. There's a plaque there to Ken Collier.
Yeah.
It says, Ken Collier, he knew. And Chris Barber was kind of telling us, you know, the whole story of the band from this point onwards. So Chris Barber played trombone. He would go on to be hugely influential, actually, in bringing over blues musicians in the early 60s.
Yeah.
Muddy Waters he brought over to the UK. So ended up inspiring people like the Rolling Stones. Also in this band, Monty Sunshine played clarinet, Ron Bowden played drums, and Tony Donegan, later to become Lonnie, was on banjo. Jim Bray played bass. Ken's the leader. And they start to do this. They start to gig and play this very kind of authentic, at this point now, version of New Orleans Dixieland jazz that Ken has, like, become a master in and brought back to the UK. So this is between 49 and 52. So, like, he wasn't actually in New Orleans for that long. So the Crane River Jazz Band, they perform at the Royal Festival Hall in 1951. They support Big Bill Brunsey in London the year after. Then he disbands that band. He goes to New Orleans. He comes back probably around 52, 53 mm-hmm. at this point, and forms this new band, the Ken Collier Band, with Chris Barber and Tony Donegan. So what would happen at these concerts is that during the interval, they were playing this, as I say, very authentic Dixieland jazz. But during the interval, they would have these kind of, they were actually called breakdown
yeah.
sessions or jams, you know, between the first and second half. And it was a chance for them to just, they were big sort of blues and
yeah.
folk fans as well as jazz fans.
Yeah.
And it was a chance for them to indulge that. And they would start to play these folk records and these blues records really sped up and in quite a visceral way. Eventually, Bill Collier joined them on Washboard and this new kind of style emerged. They didn't know what to call the music. Bill actually came up with the name Skiffle.
Yeah.
Which is now very famous.
And these, and it became hugely popular with the audiences, didn't it?
These
interval
yeah.
sessions, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Skiffle came from a band called Dan Burley and the Skiffle Boys,
okay.
who were doing a similar kind of fast-paced blues, but it wasn't the same. It didn't have these kind of makeshift mm-hmm. instruments that Skiffle became famous for. And like you say, yeah, it kind of took over in popularity. It took over the New Orleans jazz that people had originally come to see. It was just a bit more fun. Billy Bragg calls it the first ever punk.
Well, it is. It's kind of very homemade
DIY.
Instruments and, yeah, primitive sound. Yeah,
yeah. yeah. A T-chess bass became part of it. The banjo was part of it. This washboard. So it was easy to play
yeah.
and easy to manufacture. And pretty raucous
yeah.
as well. So appealed to young people. And it became hugely influential,
yeah.
which we'll come on to in just a moment. For one reason or another, Ken Collier and the band in this incarnation, it didn't last for long, just about a year. They split up. Lonnie Donegan and Chris Barber went their own way, still playing this mix of at their shows of sort of Dixieland jazz and skiffle. In 1954, they make their first record. And on this record was Rock Island Line.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after that, the rest, a lot of our listeners will know, is well-trodden history.
Well, it's the roots of British rock, isn't it, and British
it
pop?
It is. That record was just so seismic
yeah.
in its impact, wasn't it? A huge hit for Lonnie Donegan. It's actually a skiffle version, a sped-up version of a Lead Belly song. He never credited Lead Belly
right.
and was criticised for it throughout his life.
There's a lot of that about, wasn't there, yeah?
Yeah. So you've got all these kids. I mean, we mentioned it in the Scarborough Fair episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Martin Carthy was inspired to pick up a guitar after hearing Rock Island Line and form a skiffle band, and then went on to be at the forefront of the British folk revival.
Well, everybody, pretty much everybody of that generation is inspired to pick
yeah.
up a guitar by skiffle. There's a famous piece of footage that you can see that Hugh Weldon on the arts programme Monitor, I think, where he's got two young schoolboys on there. Tell me all about this skiffle that you play, and they've got their guitars, and one of them is Jimmy Page.
Absolutely.
Who says he isn't going to go into music, he's going to go into science, but he still loves skiffle, yeah.
Oh, so you've got, yeah, people like Jimmy Page,
yeah.
people like Martin Carthy. Chris Barber ran with the blues enthusiasm. He ended up being a big influence on the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
And then there was someone in Liverpool who was also hugely impacted by Lonnie and this track, who would one day go on to play, you could say, a moderate part in the development of music from that point on, John Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in a skiffle band called The Quarrymen.
He was.
There are these two brilliant photographs. I met some of the members of the Quarrymen who never went on with Lennon and McCartney to be in the Beatles. But they showed me these brilliant photographs of the Quarrymen, one from 1958 and one from 1960. And the one in 1958, they're all kind of, there's quite a few of them in the band. They're all a bit ramshackle, kitted out in kind of just normal clothes and denim. And then by 1960, I guess it was the influence of Elvis as well, wasn't it? They have, you know, these sort of sharper jackets and more sophisticated guitars and haircuts. And they're looking a lot more like a rock and roll act.
But if you look at that picture, the famous picture at the Walton Village Fete where Lennon and McCartney meet and Lennon's on stage in the Quarrymen, they're skiffle,
yeah.
aren't they? They're total skiffle. They get
yeah,
up,
yeah,
the
yeah.
check shirts and the rolled up jeans and everything. They're total
Absolutely.
Skiffle. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's what they were. They were Johnny and the Moondogs between the Quarrymen and the Beatles.
They were.
But by 1960, they were the Beatles. And, well, you could say... It was all down to
Ken Collier. So you're saying no Ken Collier, no skiffle, no British rock and roll, no Beatles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, let's hear it for Ken.
So, yeah. And like I say, at the 100 Club, there's this lovely plaque. The 100 Club was where all those rock and roll bands from the Rolling Stones played there, didn't they? It was an important place for bands like The Who as well. They all played there. And there's this lovely plaque on the wall that says, Ken Collier, he knew.
Oh. And now this podcast is a kind of audio plaque to Ken.
Yeah. As for Ken, he carried on playing and releasing the music he loved. He had ill health. He had stomach cancer. Yeah. He died when he was only 59 years old in 1988. Sad. But obviously saw all this happen. Yeah. I wonder what he made of it.
Yeah. Well, the strangest hit single ever. And Ken Collier, unsung father of British rock. We've sung him now.
There could have been no Lonnie Donegan without Ken Collier.
Well, and as I said, no British rock and roll, really, because of that.
Yeah.
If you've got a story you want us to investigate and retell, a few of you have done this already, and thank you, and we will get round to them. But please get in touch with us at NotablePod, and we will investigate it.
If you've had an easy time getting to Tennessee, then feel free.
How difficult is it to get to New Orleans?
I mean,
yeah, okay.
I mean, I was traveling with my friend Sinead Garvan, and you know, we'd struggle getting from here to Liverpool. Probably,
also, the difficulty getting to America, of course, is there are monsters apparently in the Atlantic who make transport difficult as well. Well,
and people playing the trumpet the whole time, which is really annoying.
Well, I don't know what time it is, listeners, when you listen to this podcast, but here it's early evening and there's a big glass of wine with my name on it. So
you've got to go.
I'm going to bring proceedings, festivities to a halt. We'll be back very soon with another Notable.
We will.
Lovely.
Notable, the podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.